Amongst the most common phobias in the world, there's always the usual contenders, things like fear of heights or fear of crowds. But usually somewhere amongst the top 5 or 10 most common phobias is ophidiophobia. You might say, well, I'm not sure I have ophidiophobia. It's the fear of snakes. There's something about those slithering little creatures that just makes our skin crawl. It goes back in the scriptures all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. And amongst all the fears that you could have, rational and irrational, I suppose fear of snakes is one that does make sense. And we understand that most snakes that you run into are pretty harmless. But we also know that some snakes can kill you in an instant. So a fear of snakes makes sense. And of all the snakes that you could fear, one of the most fearsome of all is the cobra. And particularly, I'm thinking this morning of the spitting cobra. It has venom in its fangs that's lethal if it bites you. But the spitting cobra also has another way of delivering its venom, as you can probably tell from the name. It is able to project its venom at its victims. It doesn't exactly spit. It uses muscles to contract its venom glands and projects its venom at its target. Now, if you get contact with spitting cobra venom, it's not likely to harm you in any serious way. But if you get it in your eyes, it could blind you permanently. And the fact is, spitting cobras most often target the face of their victims. And they launch it. And here's the scary thing. They have a range of about 6 feet and a 90% degree of accuracy. So within 6 feet, they are likely to hit what they aim at, which could be you. So you might be thinking, well, I didn't come in here with a fear of snakes today, but you're certainly giving me one. Well, the good news is, walking around in North America, you're not going to encounter a spitting cobra. They're not native to our country or to this continent. But here's the challenge, though, and here's the real danger. There is another creature wandering around North America, and in fact the entire world, that also has the ability to spit venom. Now, this creature doesn't slither on its belly. It walks on two legs. And it has an ability that no other creature has, the ability to speak. Yes, I'm talking about your neighbor, about the person sitting next to you, about people in general. You know, our words can become like a toxic venom. Last week we said that our words are like an arrow. You can load it into the bow, you can fire it, but you never know quite where it's going to land. Or maybe a better comparison is to say that our words are like a cannonball. When fired, you never know what they're going to crash through and what damage they may create along the way. But another comparison we can make is that our words are like poison. They're like venom. James says in James chapter 3, verse 8, he says, the tongue is a restless evil full of deadly poison. Those are our words, full of poison. Now here's the interesting thing about poison, is that when it's administered, usually it's administered in a way that the person doesn't know they're being poisoned. You know, it's slipped into a drink or into food in order to poison somebody, and they usually don't know until it's too late. And I thought about that. That's actually a good comparison for how we sometimes use words. We couch them in a veneer of niceness. And yet underneath, there's a lot of biting sarcasm. There's a lot of poison underneath. I grew up in the South, and in the South, people would always say, bless his heart or bless her heart. And then usually that was followed by the most harsh criticism you could imagine. You know, if you just preface it with bless her heart, you can say pretty much whatever you want about somebody. And that's how we do sometimes. Bless his heart, but he can't do this or that. You know, and we come up with ways to harm our neighbor with our words while making it sound okay. We share salacious gossip with someone in the guise of being a prayer request. You know, we say something as a joke to try to get a laugh, but the statement really does hurt and cut deeply. So our words are like poison in some ways. It's like the venom of a spitting cobra. And the poison in our words should cause us to stop and remember And I think to recognize this truth, and you'll see it there in your bulletin, our untamed tongue reveals the problem in our heart. When we allow our words to just flow without filter, it shows us something. It shows us that there's something wrong deeper than just the tongue, deeper than just our words. There's a heart problem that stands behind it all. And I think that's what James would want us to see here in James chapter 3. Now, last Sunday, we had to take this message in two parts. We looked at the first six verses of James 3. And he talks about this uncomfortable truth about our words. And as I read it, and maybe as you read it too, you think to yourself, wow, James is kind of overstating this a little bit. I mean, how is it really that bad? Are our words really that serious? And I think James would say, it's a lot worse than you think. You know, the whole of James 3, 1 to 12 has been driving at this point. Now, we had to stop midway, but let's review for a second. Let's go over what we talked about last time. James introduced us, first of all, to the serious problem of the tongue, really in verses 1 through 5. Our words are important. They have an effect that is nothing less than life-changing. Anyone who would be a teacher needs to stop and realize their words make a real difference. So we have to be careful about how we use them. Our words are more powerful than we realize. It's been said that it takes a person years to build a reputation, but it only takes a moment to destroy it. And oftentimes that happens with our words. Listen to this. This is what Billy Graham once wrote. He said, "You have a tongue and a voice. These instruments of speech can be used destructively or constructively. You can use your tongue to slander, to scold, to nag, and to quarrel, or you can bring it under the control of God's Spirit and make it an instrument of blessing and praise." In either case, whether it's untamed and violent, or whether it is under the control of the Spirit, it's a powerful thing. That's why James compares it to the bit in the mouth of a horse. The tongue, though small, controls what direction our life goes. Or, he says, like the rudder of a ship, it directs the entire vessel. But if that wasn't enough, James also introduced us not only to the serious matter or the serious problem of the tongue, but also to the destructive power of the tongue. The destructive power of the tongue. He says in verse 5, the tongue is a spark. And a little spark, just like a small bit or a rudder, can make a big difference. A little spark can set a forest ablaze. Then he says in verse 6, our words, he says, your tongue is a fire. It's a fire. And it has far-reaching impact on our lives. Think about that. Our words, it's kind of like having a blowtorch in your mouth. You can just aim it where you want. And if we thought of our words that way, as a flamethrower, we would probably be careful where we send them. Maybe we would keep our mouths closed a little bit more if we realized, you know what, these flames can burn. James, by the way, is not the only one in Scripture who makes this comparison with the tongue and a fire. He says in Proverbs 16:27, "A scoundrel plots evil, and on their lips it is a scorching fire." And that's true with our tongue. It shoots fire. And if we're not careful, we can misuse it. The destructive power of the tongue. But this morning we get to verse 7. And James keeps building his argument here. He keeps building the case, showing us the serious problem that is our tongue. So I want to invite you to look at number 3, which is the uncontrollable nature of the tongue. The uncontrollable nature of the tongue. Well, let's pick up in verse 7. James writes, "For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison." I would say that by this point in James chapter 3, it's pretty clear what James thinks about our words. But we might be saying to ourselves, yeah, okay, it's a problem. I know that I sometimes say the wrong thing. Sometimes I use my words to hurt. But can't we just rein it in? Can't I just exercise some self-control? Can't I just maybe read a book on, you know, 5 steps to controlling your tongue? Wouldn't that help? Well, it's much more serious than that. Here's the challenge. The tongue refuses to be domesticated. People try to restrain it. They try to do better. Good example is some people will set up a swear jar where they'll have a jar, and when they use words that are inappropriate, I'll put a dollar in or a quarter in to, you know, try and teach me not to say those words. But what ends up happening? You end up collecting enough money to go on vacation. The tongue resists efforts to try to control it. That's what James is telling us. Now, even people who appear to have a good control on their tongues, there are people you might say, well, they don't speak their mind every opportunity. You know, they hold their tongue. They're wise. But what do they say when the chips are down? What do they say when they're stressed or worried? What happens when they hit rock bottom? What do they say then? You know, if you control your tongue 80% of the time, but still let it loose 20% of the time, you've not tamed the tongue. You managed to work it into a corner, but it's still just as dangerous as it ever was. So James says in James 3, verse 7, he says, every kind of beast and bird and reptile and sea creature. He mentions 4 different categories of creatures that have all been tamed by mankind. And by the way, you'll notice if you've been reading in Genesis recently, this follows the same pattern, the same categories you find there. For instance, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, the Bible says, let us make man in our own image, after our own likeness. Let him have dominion, control, over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, over livestock and every creeping thing. See the 4 categories? Bird, fish, beasts of the ground, and creeping things. Well, here, James says the same thing. Beasts of the ground, birds, creeping things, and sea creatures. So it's the same categories drawn from Genesis. And what did Genesis say? Man will be given dominion over them, control. He will be able to exercise dominion over creation. And James says that's happened. We've done that. We've been able to go out and control the beast. Now, that doesn't mean every animal has been domesticated so that it could be, you know, live in your house like a pet. But here's what Homer Kent writes. He says, even though man has not been able to make a pet out of every wild beast or sea creature, he has been able to capture, cage, or at least otherwise control any creature he wishes. So James says, man has tamed the beast. He says, can be tamed or has been tamed by mankind. In other words, he uses sort of the past and the present. He says, all these creatures have been tamed, that we have them now tamed, and in the past, people have done this. This is not something new. People have been doing this from the dawn of time, taming the animals. Again, I want to look at these 4 categories, though, because we can see examples of this in our modern world. Every kind of beast has been tamed. You know, people have trained pets, dogs, to roll over, to do all kinds of incredible things. Sea creatures and birds. He says birds have been trained. We can think of carrier pigeons and things like that. But what about a parrot? You know, parrots have been trained to mimic human conversation and human words. Not only do we see, you know, beasts and birds, but also reptiles, he mentions. You think of like a snake charmer, for instance, who is able to manipulate the snake in the basket. And then my favorite, he mentions here also sea creatures. Now, sea creatures are probably the hardest ones to get under our control, right? Because we live in different environments. And yet, have you ever been to SeaWorld? There's marvelous things that even sea creatures can be trained to do. I remember the first time I ever saw in person a dolphin show. It blew me away. I'd seen dolphins performing tricks on TV. I've watched Flipper. But to see it in person was something else. You know, these dolphins doing backflips through loops and hitting balls and diving and jumping on command, all this stuff. It was incredible to think the amount of time that people had spent working with these animals to try to teach them these tricks. I remember a few years ago, I took our kids to a dog show. And by a dog show, I don't mean like a beauty pageant for dogs like you see sometimes. It was a performance, you know, where they had these dogs trained to jump through hoops and leap over top of their trainers and grab balls and walk on two legs and all this kind of thing. And it's amazing. It's amazing to see how people have been able to train animals to do these sorts of things. James' point here, though, is that even though we have done all of this with all the creatures of the world, as deadly as they may be, man still can't tame himself. He still can't tame his own tongue. He says this in verse 8. He says, but no human being can tame the tongue. There's a little bit of an awkwardness in the translation here. Most of our modern English translations kind of smooth it a little bit. But the first awkwardness that's not really always translated is the expression he talks about with mankind and human being. So at the end of verse 7, he says, every creature's been tamed by mankind. And then he kind of repeats himself saying, but mankind cannot tame the tongue. So sort of like a parallelism here. You know, man has mastery of the beasts, but man does not have mastery over himself. There's another awkwardness in this verse, though, and it has to do with the word human beings. Again, my version moves it to the front. No human being can tame the tongue. But in the original language, in Greek, mankind comes at the end. It says, you know, again, this is a little bit of an awkward translation, but it's kind of literal. No one is able to subdue the tongue among men. That's kind of how it reads. No one's able to subdue the tongue among men. It's almost like it's tacked on to the end. And the effect, I think, is to say, no human can tame the tongue. It leaves it open to outside help. No person can tame the tongue, but maybe there is someone out there. Someone who is more than just a man. And that's pretty important. We're going to come back to that a little bit later. But verse 8, though, gives us two reasons why the tongue cannot be tamed. Two reasons why the tongue cannot be tamed. Number one, it is unpredictably evil. It is unpredictably evil. You see this in verse 8. No human being can tame the tongue. Why? It is a restless evil. A restless evil. The word restless here means it cannot be trusted to stay submissively in its proper place. I think of this like a caged lion. You can put a lion in a cage, but it's restless. It's pacing back and forth. It's looking for an opportunity to tear through those bars and break free. And that seems to be the picture, perhaps, of what James is getting at, this restless evil that is our tongue. Even if we can quiet it for a second, it's still pacing. It's waiting for its moment to lash out. And so we may be very pleasant in talking with others, and we may not say anything offensive for quite a while, but then when somebody really pushes our buttons, when something happens that just, really bugs me, that's when that restless evil breaks forth. Here's an interesting thing, though. The word that's translated restless here has been used once before by James. He used it back in chapter 1, verse 8, where there he said, the double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Same word, restless. So you could say this is an unstable evil. It's unpredictable. It's not something that you can rely on. I think of this like a volcano. You know, volcanoes are unpredictable. Now granted, you know, seismologists and different people and volcanologists can study, and they know perhaps when things are building and pressure is building up in the earth. But especially in James' time, a volcano is a restless, boiling, superheated, dangerous event. A good example, if you go out to Yellowstone National Park, I know some of you guys have been there before, but you go to Yellowstone, and it's an interesting place, right? Because you have all these thermal features. You have Old Faithful, the geyser, which is anything but unpredictable, right? I mean, you can set your clock to Old Faithful. Geyser comes shooting out of the ground. But there's all kinds of other thermal features around there as well. Do you know why? It's because Yellowstone is the largest supervolcano in North America. And it's active. Doesn't make you feel very safe, does it? That the middle of our country is just one giant volcano waiting to erupt. Now, thankfully, most volcanologists say that Yellowstone is not in peril of blowing up this week. In fact, one of the things that helps is you have all these vents at Yellowstone that help relieve some of the pressure that builds up under the ground. Nevertheless, what's going on underneath the ground? It's not stable. It's not, you know, calm and everything at peace. No, it's churned up. There's pressure building. There's danger beneath the surface. And that's what James is saying about our tongue. It's a restless evil. It may look calm on the surface, just like Mount St. Helens looked calm for a while. And then suddenly, one day, it blew up. And so it is with our tongue. Sometimes we walk around and we seem to have a good control on it, and then something happens and we just blow up. We say something foolish. We say something wicked. It's a restless, unpredictable evil. That's our tongue. You can't tame a volcano, and you can't control an unruly tongue. Sooner or later, it's going to bubble up and it's going to bubble over. Second reason why you can't train the tongue, though, it's unpredictably evil, and secondly, it's unbelievably dangerous. Unbelievably dangerous. In verse 8, he says, not only is it a restless evil, he says it is a deadly poison, full of deadly poison. Again, the picture, I think, is well represented by the spitting cobra. Full of poison. It would kill you as soon as look at you. And so our words, though they sit idle for a time, perhaps, when they are sent out and when we do bite, we release that deadly venom. Again, he doesn't just say poison or venom. He says deadly poison. This is something that can kill. Here's the point. James is saying man cannot control the tongue. If he could use a modern expression, I think James would say, trying to control the tongue is like herding cats. You know that expression? Herding cats. Now, cats are domesticated, but they're not trainable, are they? Nobody trains a cat to do anything. Cats do exactly what they want to do. And so the idea of herding cats is absurd, and so is taming the tongue. You know, try as we might, we still say things that we regret. We say things that hurt. Somebody cuts in line in front of us. We have to bite our tongue not to say something snarky or insulting. You know, when your husband or your wife or your kids do something that just really bugs you, you can't seem to help but vent that anger. We criticize, we belittle, we insult, we curse, we lie, we brag, we judge, all with our words. Now, we can try to shut up. We can try and hold our tongue. But even the most even-keeled, calm persona sometimes finds their tongue unleashed. Professional golfer Ryan McCormick knows how hard it can be to hold one's tongue. Last year, last April in 2025, Ryan McCormick was part of a golf competition. And during the last half of the competition, or during the second round, he was seen walking around the golf course literally with tape over his mouth. And you can go see the pictures. He's walking around with what looks like scotch tape around his mouth. And afterwards, he said to a reporter, and I listened to the interview, he said, I've tried lots of things. I figured I'd shut myself up, he said. He went on to say, I've read lots of books. I've talked to people. I'm just too angry on the golf course. I've run out of ideas, and I thought of the tape. It was interesting, if you keep listening to the interview, he goes on to say, I'm not sure if it helped or not. You see, he would walk around the golf course and explode into blasphemies and profanities, and so he felt like, there's nothing I can do to control myself, and so tape seemed like the best option. And maybe it did help, but it didn't tame the tongue. James presents us with this uncontrollable nature of the tongue. But lastly, as we close out this section, James points out the twisted dichotomy of the tongue. The twisted dichotomy of the tongue. There's something disturbingly schizophrenic about the way that we talk. We use our words and our mouths in contradictory ways. We use it to bless, we use it to curse. We use it for praise and for profanity. We use it for good and for evil. Listen to what James says in James chapter 3, verse 9. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse people who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers, these things ought not to be so. There's this Jekyll and Hyde type reality with our tongues. And this is why James' words here are so hard-hitting, you know. We might think to ourselves, certainly the tongue is not that bad. I mean, most people that I talk to aren't slinging venom in every conversation. Okay, well, good. But it's not how we use our tongue on the nice, on the good days when we're with polite company that really reveals our heart, is it? It's when things go badly. It's how we use it when our guard is down that shows what's within. Now, we have a little expression in English that we use for this. It's called a Freudian slip. That's named from Sigmund Freud, who was a psychologist who had all kinds of nutty ideas, really, about the unconscious self and so forth. Nevertheless, we call it a Freudian slip whenever somebody says something without thinking and lets out what they really think, usually a negative opinion about someone or something. And so the Freudian slip kind of has a way of showing what's really there. Yeah, we may talk nice most of the time, but then something slips out that reveals where our heart is. And that's one of the things that James keeps confronting here in this book. He's talking about the double-minded man. Remember that back in chapter 1? He used the Greek word dipsukes, two-souled, a two-souled person. You know, this book is about faith demonstrated, but faith demonstrated only half the time is not real faith. It's just a charade. If we try to control our tongues half the time, it really shows how little control we have. James points out here the sinful inconsistency of our tongue. He says in verse 9, we use it to bless our Father and we use it to curse people made in his likeness. And this, frankly, is a very sad testimony that's all too often played out. The mouth is used to praise God, but then for other things as well. The same lips that sing holy, holy, holy on Sunday morning curse the driver who cuts them off on the way home from church. We say amen on Sunday, but then we take the Lord's name in vain throughout the week. He says, with our tongues, we bless God, we understand that, we sing praise, all that. But then he says we curse people made in the likeness of God. Do you remember I said back in verse 7, James uses four categories of creatures from Genesis 1:26? That same verse, Genesis 1:26, also says, in his likeness God made them, after his image. So clearly James has this verse in his mind as he's writing here. But we bless God on Sunday, we curse people made in his image. And I think this is probably nowhere clearer than when we curse people because of who they are. When James was writing this, he was writing primarily to a Jewish audience. The Jews in the time of James didn't think much of Gentiles. In fact, they looked down upon them and probably said some pretty cruel and hurtful and mean and evil things about the Gentiles. I would say in today's church, we have just as much a problem with Gentiles who say terribly anti-Semitic things about the people God chose. And so it goes back and forth. And it's not just Jew and Gentile. It's black and white. It's every kind of distinction people use their tongues to berate and to belittle people who are different and yet made in the image of God. He says, this is the sinful inconsistency of our tongues. It continues into verse 10. He says, the same mouth come blessing and cursing. So he follows this sinful inconsistency up with a sincere reproof. And I say sincere here because James doesn't, you notice he doesn't come down too hard on them. You may say, well, he's come down pretty hard on the tongue already. But he says in verse 10, my brothers, these things ought not be so. You notice how gentle he handles this reproof. He says, listen, here's what's happening. And this shouldn't be. He doesn't say, you wicked sinners, stop using your tongue like that. No, he says, listen, this is not how it's supposed to be. Because I think James puts himself in this category. I'm one who has a propensity to misuse my words. So he comes down gently, and but it's sincere. He says, you can't live this way. This is not right. Being double-minded in your speech is the height of hypocrisy. You know, what would you say if you learned somebody who half the time they were serving others and they were very altruistic, they were very, you know, considerate and kind, and the other half of the time they were manipulative and deceitful? You would not say that's a good person. You would not even say that person is half good. You would say that person is a snake. That person is devious and hypocritical. See, there's something here that we need to notice, and that is, it's not the record of the many good things that we've said that shows our heart. It's the things that bubble up when stress enters our life. So, sinful inconsistency, sincere reproof. And then lastly, James lists some samples from nature, some examples. He says in verses 11 and 12, does the spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and salt water? Can a fig tree, my brothers, produce olives? Or a grapevine produce figs? Neither can a salt pond yield fresh water. So a couple of examples, a couple of samples of nature that he uses. Again, James is always one for a good illustration. He uses one here. He says, can a spring pour forth salt and fresh water? Now, we have examples of both of them. There are saltwater springs and there are freshwater springs. But you will never find one that sometimes pours forth salt and sometimes pours forth fresh water. Because where is that water coming from? There's a reservoir down under the ground somewhere from which, or maybe a stream under the ground that's pouring forth this spring. So you see the point of the illustration? What comes out of the spring is coming from a source. It's coming from a heart. And the same with our words. They flow out of our heart. You can't have one and the other. And that's why he says, brothers, this can't be. Even nature shows us. Nature proves to us you can't have one fountain and two sources. Then he uses the example of the tree. A fig tree produces figs. An olive tree, olives. A grapevine, grapes. You can't have, something producing various fruits. The tree produces a fruit in accordance with its nature. Then last, he says, the salt pond doesn't produce fresh water. So if you have a pond or let's say a lake, a good example might be the Dead Sea in Israel. It's the most saline lake in the world. The Dead Sea, if you ever go there, you basically cannot sink in the Dead Sea. It's too buoyant. You'll float. But you also cannot get a drink of it because it's undrinkable. It's too salty. And so, can you imagine somebody going down to the Dead Sea trying to take a drink? James says, you're never going to get fresh water from a salt pond. You're never going to get fresh water from the Dead Sea. It's not going to happen. There's this wicked dichotomy with our tongues. Even as believers, we have this. Even if we've been born again, we still struggle. It's not like God just changes our nature wholly and completely all in one second. There's still a struggle. There's still an ongoing battle with sin. There's a war within. So even though we have a new heart and we have been changed by the power of the Spirit, we still struggle to use our tongue in a way that honors God. This terrible, twisted dichotomy that is our words. J. Vernon McGee, famous radio preacher, shares a story from early in his ministry. He was going to go into ministry as a young man, and he met a local banker who said, I hope when you go into ministry, you're the real kind of Christian. And McGee said, well, what do you mean by that? And he told him a story. He said, I was a banker. I was working as a vice president of this bank, and we hired a young man who became a teller. This young man also, on the weekends, went to a Baptist church downtown Nashville, Tennessee, and had a beautiful singing voice. He would get up and he would sing solos during the church service. Well, one of the ladies from the church also did her banking there. And she came in and told this vice president, she said, oh, this young new teller that you just hired, he's one of the most wonderful men. I mean, he sings like an angel. Well, one particular day, she came into the bank to do some business. She was sitting there with the vice president. And outside at the teller's desk, they heard just a tirade of profanity, blasphemy. And she said, what in the world is that? And the bank vice president looked at her and said, that's your soloist who sings like an angel on Sunday. He said, that's what turned me away from religion. That hypocrisy, that twisted dichotomy of the tongue. Here's what I wonder. If we could have a full transcript of all of your conversations for the past month, what would we find? What would be in those transcripts? My guess is, and hopefully it would be, many pleasant and wonderful things have come out of your mouth over the past month. But I would also guess there's probably some things that you would like to have redacted on that transcript. Yeah, just mark that line out. I kind of wish I hadn't said that. That's what James is trying to show us. The terrible, untamable tongue. And I know it's a negative picture that he paints here in these 12 verses. You notice, by the way, he doesn't end with an answer. He doesn't end with one last verse saying, here's how to change. Here's what to do. He just kind of lets it sit. There's almost like a tension in the air. It's like, okay, James, you told us how terrible and how dangerous and how potentially deadly the tongue is. And then he just kind of moves on. You say, well, what's the answer? What's the solution? Our tongue is a restless evil. What do? And I think James allows us to simply soak in this truth. And when we do, he invites us to think about our words. In conclusion, this passage reminds us of two things. It reminds us of two things. First of all, it reminds us that there's something wrong with our hearts. It's not just our words. It's not just the way we speak. Now, some people would like to say, well, you know, I kind of disconnect our words from where they come from. But your tongue doesn't act independently of your heart. There is a direct line that connects what's in your heart with your mouth. And what may seem like a Freudian slip is actually just our honest, unfiltered thoughts. Word problems are heart problems. And whatever is in your heart is going to rule your words. There's no better evidence of our own sinfulness and our own fallenness than the way that we talk. So I think it's very appropriate that you and I should be convicted by this passage when we look at our own words. And we look and we say, you know what? I'm not the good person that I like to think that I am. My words reveal that there's something really, really wrong deep down. Also, by the way, reminds us, this isn't one of the points, but it also reminds us of someone who never used his words for evil. There was one who walked this earth who never used his tongue to destroy, to tear down, to perform evil. It says in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 22, he committed no sin, neither was deceit found on his mouth. So even though our tongue is probably the clearest indication that there's something wrong deep down in our hearts, there was someone who came to this earth who was deeply right in his heart. So it shows us and reminds us there's something wrong with our hearts. Number two, it reminds us of our need for transforming grace. Our need for transforming grace. I want to go back for just one second to verse 8. James 3, 8 says, no human being can tame the tongue. The tongue cannot be subdued among men. There is hope for us, not that we can tame our own tongue, but that there is one who can. Here's how the church father Augustine said it. He says, James does not say no one can tame the tongue, but no man. So that when it is tamed, we admit that it was done by the mercy of God, the assistance of God, and the grace of God. See, as believers, we need transforming grace in our lives. The grace that saves us, that brings us into God's family, yes. But it doesn't stop working after we're saved. It keeps working to change us, to teach us to say no to ungodliness and to submit ourselves to the Lord. That's transforming grace. That's the power of Christ in our hearts. And it works slowly, and it works steadily in our lives. It's not that, you know, in an instant suddenly our words are purified and totally upright. God's transforming grace is working throughout the length of our life to change us. And it's through passages like this that the Holy Spirit uses to show us we need to change. So what you and I need is transforming grace in our lives. The answer for our terrible tongue is not the Ryan McCormick fix. Slap some tape on it and hope that helps. It's not trying to do better and bite our tongue. The answer is found in the Spirit of God ruling our hearts. By grace are you saved, but it's by God's grace you're transformed. It changes the way we talk. I want to close with these words. This is from preacher Ray Pritchard. He says this: only heaven can replace the hell in our mouths. Only Jesus can replace the fire of hatred with the sweet aroma of grace. Only God can change us from the inside out.